With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Pelle Neroth-Taylor, live from Sweden on today's News Talk, TNT.
Okay, well, we're going to move away from Russian issues now. We've got to suspend Pelle Neroth-Taylor on TNT News Talk. We're going to talk a little bit about Trump, who's disappointed a lot of his fans, I think, when he seemingly supported this Mike Johnson, the head of the House of Representatives, green-lighting of this massive aid package for Ukraine. I mean, what is Trump doing? Is he really loyal to his MAGA constituencies, thinking about reforms in America first? And there are various, lots of speculation, you know, is he somebody blackmailing him, or is he just a strategic vision he has, support for Israel, maybe he's got Israeli donors. I don't know. It'll come out in the wash. But I just want to say that whatever happens to Trump, and of course there's some hopeful optimism saying that, well, Trump, when he comes to power, he will end this war. I mean, Viktor Orban said, pray Trump wins. But whether Trump wins or has the election stolen from him, whatever happens, I think it's very good to highlight the issues that Trump raises, because what we are hoping to have is whether Trump wins or loses, is there's going to be someone after Trump. And we're going to have somebody who looks towards the rejuvenation of America, or taking what's best in America and basically saving America. And part of that saving is, of course, in my view, taking on a policy that is anti-imperial, yet pro-American. And in what some people are doing in the sort of MAGA community is going back to the philosophy and the events of America's Revolutionary War. And so that brings us to our first guest, who's going to come on at 20 past, Barry Hinckley, who's the primary drafter of what's called the Redeclaration of Independence. He's himself a descendant of Colonel James Barrett, the commander of the Minutemen who engaged the British in 1775 in Concord, Massachusetts. And he wears that, he's a proud wearer of that honor or burden or whatever you want to call it. But he'll tell us about his project to bring America back to its constitutional roots in a world where the American elite and the American congressmen seem to be absolutely swamped by corruption. Our second guest in this hour is pivot over to Sweden, which is Ingrid Carlqvist. She's a Swedish journalist and dissident journalist. And then what I'm hoping to talk about, because I've followed her for many years, she's a very fearless and intelligent woman, is how Swedish democracy has also failed the Swedes. You must know that in all the various Freedom House rankings and all the rest of it, Sweden comes up as a top five democracy in the world, you know, maybe some top one or two. So if Sweden is bad, and that you believe me, you don't know the Swedish intellectual sphere, there are loads and loads of people who convinced that Sweden is the worst country in the world, believe it or not. But there are problems with Swedish democracy. So if Swedish democracy is bad, I mean, pushing NATO decisions through was bad. This latest transgender rule law is terrible for democracy, in my view, because most people were forced into it. How bad is not other democracies in Europe? So Ingrid will tell us a little bit about that, and she'll tell us about some of the consequences of the bad democracy for Sweden. It's a country that's lost its sovereignty in many areas and has become basically another country. I'm just going to give a heads up, because I'm hoping to interview this guy maybe later this week, but we're talking a pivot over to Britain, where I have a long-standing beef, a little bit, a comic, humorous beef with Basil Valentine, our political editor, about Brexit, whether it's a good or bad thing. And there's a guy called Angus Hanton who talks about the vassal state in his book of that name, about Britain being a country where even Weetabix is owned by American venture capitalists. And 9 out of 10 Netflix films, which of course Netflix being owned by the Americans, is American. According to this guy, I have no idea, but British kids now increasingly speaking with American accents. And of course, we've got a prime minister who worked for an American investment bank and hedge fund based in California. American private equity firms basically scoop in like Las Vegas gamblers on a winning streak, the entire British industry and the British companies, and the British political elite sort of smile at it and call it capitalism. And what you've got, as Hanton highlighted, is the Philip Hammond, a former transport secretary, compelled Network Rail to sell 5,000 railway arches, where lots of businesses had a home and did well out of, to the US private equity giant Blackstone. Rents promptly doubled, putting many small companies out of business and destroying jobs. Now, I mean, I'm for capitalism, but what sort of capitalism is that? We've got Hammond said that the sort of small businesses, you know, little sort of bakers and all the rest of it, are hopeless people, are bureaucratically unable to get anything done. Lord Hammond is now a partner at the private equity firm Buckthorn and a person with significant property control over 7 property development companies. So we're hoping to have him on because Brexit only means Brexit, I think, when the British are sovereign, even from their large neighbour across the pond. Anyway, we're going to go into our next news talk with Basil Valentine, our political editor, after the break. This is the Pelaneros Taylor Show on TNT.
The facts, no spin or agenda.
Not enough with the lies, we need the facts.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the show, Basil Valentine, our political editor. What do you reckon on, do you think Brexit was incomplete in the sense that they didn't discuss the American influence when they went mad and talking about the European influence?
Well, yes. I mean, we don't have any formal relationship with the United States other than the so-called special relationship forged at the end of the Second World War, which means that, as of course, the founding nation of the United States, it was a British colony prior to the War of Independence, believe it or not. Some people think it still is. And that the City of London and the Crown still exert enormous influence over Washington. Other people say, of course, it's the other way around. And still more people say that the United States' special relationship is now with Israel, who is often described as its most important ally. And it's to that subject that I want to pivot, Pelle, because there's some real visceral politics going on in the United States at the moment with the widespread protests across university and now school campuses in support both of the Palestinian cause and indeed the simpler end to genocide, the two being obviously side by side, but not all the people calling for an end to genocide are necessarily supporters of the Palestinian cause. Now, this is a very fast-moving scenario. It began last week with an encampment at Columbia University and the arrest of dozens of students by the New York police on the instruction of the university's principal. Following that, there was a demonstration at New York University yesterday, which turned chaotic, with the NYPD reporting that they officers were pelted with bottles after the university called them to assist with dispersing a growing crowd and encampment of students, anti-genocide students, there. On Monday, also, protesters were arrested at an encampment set up on the campus at Yale. Back at Columbia, more than 100 students have now been arrested, but the faculty, the university lecturers, have come out in favor of the students and called upon the principal to restore free speech and freedom of association to the campus. Pro-Palestinian encampments have also been established now at the University of Michigan, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and California State Polytechnic University at Humboldt. Meanwhile, just today, hundreds of Seattle area students are planning a walkout in protest at the Israel-Hamas war, demanding an end to American support of Israel and an end to the occupation of the Palestinian territories. We are looking for people of good conscience to be our partners and allies. That's a different point, because needless to say, these protests are being deliberately mischaracterized by bad faith actors, as was the case in Britain with Gideon Falter, as somehow anti-Semitic. Tom Cotton, that reprehensible senator, tweeted the following: "The nascent pogroms at Columbia have to stop today before our Jewish brethren sit for Passover Seder tonight. If Eric Adams won't send in the NYPD and Kathy Hochul won't send the National Guard, Joe Biden has a duty to take charge and break up these mobs." Well, of course, the mobs that Cotton is referring to include a lot of Jewish students as well. They've been putting out statements, obviously, in support of the encampments. So, you know, this is turning into really deep divisions within American society, really polarized opinions with seemingly no common ground, even more so than was the case in the Vietnam War in the early 1970s.
But I was going to say, it just reeks of Vietnam. It's almost nostalgic, because it's the sort of thing that we're associate students with doing, which is protest against war. And it seems that they found a cause. I mean, we've often wondered whatever happened to the peace movement, you know? Why are the feminists worried about whatever, you know, seats on boards, when they're not worrying about slaughters of people in Gaza or the fact of war? I mean, the thing that women, one of the things, virtues of women, is their strong reluctance to harm. You know, in psychological surveys, there's a very, very strong anti-harm component of female psychology. Hasn't been present when you look at all those women in power in Europe and America who've wished this war on. Well, now we've seen a return to those things that we associate with the old left, or the student left, protesting against war and protesting against genocide, as you say, in a way that, I don't know, I mean, they certainly didn't do, for, let's say, the Rwanda genocide or even the Ukraine war, although that was not a genocide. So I think it's a very encouraging trend, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. It's one of the best things happening in America, frankly, at the moment. Particularly the fact that the faculty have come out at Columbia, with the exception, of course, of people like Shai Davidi, a tenured Columbia University business professor, who was caught on camera throwing a really childish hissy fit at the encampment and tweeted out about how appalling it was to see Muslim students praying. This he found to be a direct threat. An article by Joshua Frank in Counterpunch this week points out that he has links to Israeli arms manufacturers through his family's companies. Jewish Voice for Peace students have called on Davidi directly. The disgraceful Shai Davidi publicly called us Judenrat Kapost and told us we would be on the last train to Auschwitz. We do not feel safe with this professor still teaching on campus, having access to the Jewish community spaces we cherish, much less portraying himself as a valiant protector and spokesperson of Jews on campus while insulting our ancestors' memory. Almost every suspended Jewish student lost family members in the Holocaust. So you've got Jewish students being suspended by Gentiles for support for opposing a genocide brought about by Zionists, which is supported by Zionist professors who want to see the anti-genocide Jewish students sent on trains to Auschwitz. Make sense of it, Pelle.
I see this as part of a general trend. I mean, it's 80 years since the end of the Cold World War II, and we've basically lived in the mental framework of World War II for 80 years. It's coincided with the Anglo-American Empire and the sort of Zionist offshoots. But we're seeing these magic invocations of words like Auschwitz and 1938 and Munich and death camps and trains to to gas chambers. They're losing some of the invocational power. All you need to do it once upon a time is to say that, and that killed all discussion, and everybody hung their heads in shame or whatever. And now we're seeing an overuse of those words. And as you said, the logic topples, the logic doesn't hold up anymore, and the magic doesn't hold up because it doesn't work out. It doesn't work rationally because it's being used against anti-genocide protesters. So it's a big psychological, I can see the kind of liberation of something in the American debate. Don't you see that too? There's a kind of liberty. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, at the core of it is this endless conflation between Zionism and Judaism, and that opposition to Zionism and the homicidal psychopath acts of the Israeli state is somehow an attack on all Jewish people or on the Jewish faith. So you end up with the ridiculous situation of people like Tom Cotton and Representative Anthony Desposito, congressman, who tweeted out, an attack on Israel is an attack on America. It is an attack on our values. I let anti-Semites at Columbia know that their hate has no home here. So there's this deliberate mischaracterization of people opposing genocide as somehow hateful. And you have Gentiles accusing Jews of being anti-Semites. What?
But it's the same. I mean, you have a lot of, in Sweden, I had a woman looking after hundreds of people who've been suffered from domestic abuse, being called a racist because she attributed some of that to radical Islam, and she was a Muslim herself. So it won't work as much as it used to, you know, these invocations. And we're moving into it. We really are seeing a turning in the page of history from the end of the post-war era. Anyway,
I just want to say, central to that, if we are to move forward, is that we have to establish some new moral absolutes, regardless of whose hand is on the gun. And surely opposition to genocide is an irrefutable moral absolute that we can all agree on, Pelle.
Right. Okay. Basil, you're absolutely right. And what our first guest in this second hour, we're going to talk about a sort of reconstruction of the American morality tale, the way it tells about itself with reference to the US Constitution, which, of course, is almost a holy document in the American psyche. So thanks, Basil. We'll talk to you tomorrow. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. We've got our first guest on very quickly now.
TNT's Kate Shimarani.
And I got this one thing and I thought, oh, it's because I'm a woman. No. There was a bloke came behind me with one thing and they went, please, go ahead of us. And I said, fellas, this is fabulous. I just don't see people do this anymore. And they weren't British. I said, where are you from? And one of them said, we're from Albania. He said, we're not criminals. We're just people, we work. But people say such bad things about us. Please, we're not bad. And I said, well, listen, I don't look at you and think you're a criminal because your accent. I said, do I look like a criminal? They went, no. I went, well, I am convicted. And I said, by most of the criminals in their uniforms working for the government, the tyrannical government.
Kate Shimarani on today's News Talk, TNT. A better business tip from TNT Radio. The benefits of advertising on today's News Talk, TNT Radio, should be clear to businesses of any shape or size. It can be accessed anywhere, anytime, by anybody, and is the perfect way to build brand awareness and stimulate digital activity. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live. The Net Zero Con will leave millions of citizens dependent on state handouts. It isn't a theory. It's an agenda. There is no climate emergency. On air 24/7. This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on this afternoon in late April. We've got Barry Hinckley with us, who's going to talk to us about the US Constitution and the Redeclaration of Independence. Of course, the American Constitution is a source of great admiration for many of us in Europe, a fantastic document that really changed the world and the way that we looked at man's rights as an individual in the world ever since. America, of course, is a country on the defensive at the moment. And Barry is a great-grandson of Colonel James Barrett, commander of the Minutemen, who engaged the British in 1775 in Concord, Massachusetts. Coincidentally, he was born on the 18th of April, the day the Riders left Boston to alert the Minutemen. He's a software entrepreneur, having co-founded Bullhorn Software, a former U.S. senatorial candidate from Rhode Island. He's been active in pursuing limited government and constitutional values since the Tea Party movement. I guess we remember that. You can check him out on redeclaration.org. Welcome to the show, Barry. Tell us about your project.
Well, it's fantastic to be here, and hopefully it's a resurrection of the traditional American constitutional values, which set the stage for this amazing, and as I think as you pointed out in your open, one of the most amazing experiments in human governance in human history.
Can you sort of dig down into what it consists of? I mean, what are the partial elements of this project, and who are you engaging, and what are you hoping to achieve on the larger scale of things?
Well, first of all, who we're engaging? We're engaging the citizenry, so what we, the people of the United States, and we're hoping to also engage and direct our representatives in Washington, D.C. I mean, the big problem we feel, many Americans feel today, is we are underrepresented or not represented at all by Washington, D.C. There's a huge disconnect between what we in the states call the flyover states, or all the people, and then the coastal elites that seem to be running the show. And those of us, the rest of us, feel forgotten. Now, the Redeclaration of Independence is our attempt to call attention to 10 really burning problems that we have today in this country. Now, not all the problems, but you know, in the spirit of focusing, we've pointed out 10 things like border security, balancing our budget. You know, America is massively in debt, and this isn't just bad for America and our future generations. It's bad for the world. I mean, as they say, and as you know, Pele, you know, when America sneezes, the world catches a cold, and an indebted, bankrupt America doesn't serve the world. So these are the things we're focused on with the Redeclaration of Independence.
Okay, so you just said two of them, right? I'm not surprised those two on the list, but I'm quite curious about what do the other eight look like? Can you list some of the other eight?
Yeah, well, I mean, term limits, it's a big deal. And one of the problems we have in America is our founders probably missed this because they never thought that the representatives, people that were going for self-service as they were going in the early days of our republic, to serve in Washington, D.C. on behalf of the people, they never, ever envisioned that people would turn it into a career. They thought they were going to be citizen legislators. So they never, you know, sort of plugged that loophole of term limits. So term limits is a big one, and we've limited it to 12 years.
Isn't Nancy Pelosi who's that head at the head of the Republicans,
Mitch McConnell.
They've been there forever, haven't they? I mean, they're like
Chuck Schumer.
Incredible.
Yeah, 30 plus years. It's been a career for them. And then sadly, many of them leave worth tens or hundreds of millions of dollars, all making $175,000 a year and maintaining two homes. I'd like to learn how to do that myself.
And incumbents usually win, so there's very little rotation. For a democracy to work, you need rotation and competition in political power. But once you're in there in the Senate, they tend to stay there. And if they want to stay there, you have these people out of touch and in their 70s and 80s. I'm all for experience, but not for experience in grafting for 30 or 40 years, as these guys have got. Anyway, tell us what the other seven, or carry on down your list.
Well, to your point, I mean, just to cover that one, it's statistically impossible. They get reelected 98% of the time. No one pulls anything off 98% of the time. It's statistically, the best husband and wife don't get along that often. It is impossible, and they have the deck stacked. So very important one, term limits. Securing our border, a big deal in America as we pump, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars around the world to secure borders, whether they be in Jordan, whether they be in Israel, or whether they be in the Ukraine. We haven't secured our own border. I mean, 12 or 13 million people traipsing across your border unchecked. That's not a secure border, and you're not a nation if you don't have one in the first place. So big deal.
Can I just pick you up on that? We'll go through like this. I don't understand why Trump seemed to be surrendering on this border issue. I mean, I don't know what the technicalities are, but he met with Mike Johnson last week, and he seemed to give his blessing to this Ukraine bill, which is protecting someone else's borders, but doesn't have a domestic border component. Am I misquoting it? Is that correct? I mean, what's Trump doing there? Because that's not smart MAGA policy, is it?
It doesn't seem to be, and that one totally, I'm lost for words on that one at all, because it is the most popular topic in America right now is the lack of our own southern border being secured. So I don't have an explanation for that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he's got a gun to his head metaphorically. Has he got a strategy? I don't know. It's maybe he doesn't want a border deal because an open border was 2 or 3 months down the line is going to make the Biden position even worse. Anyway, what's next on your list?
Well, securing our elections, there's a massive amount of distrust right now in America. Once we went to these, I mean, there was distrust before with the machines, and there's been articles, and you know, the Democrats were talking about their distrust with the machines and with the voting process for a decade or so before these elections, as were Republicans. Once we went to the mail-it-in everywhere, no excuse balloting, which I know is illegal in many European countries because it's so rife with fraud, people lost a lot of trust in our elections, and that trust needs to be restored. And you can't sweep this one under the rug. So securing our elections is a big deal, and it's on the list as well.
Yeah. Okay, we'll carry on down this list after a very quick news break because people haven't had their news fixed for half an hour. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show, back in a minute or so with our third guest. Thank you.
What time is it?
Now, TNT Radio News.
You know what time it is.
Yeah. Time to read some news.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. During a training session in Malaysia, two military helicopters collided mid-air and crashed, resulting in the deaths of all 10 crew members on board. Retired Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz accused the office of New York District Attorney Alvin Bragg of violating voters' rights through its prosecution of former President Donald Trump. Russian presidential spokesman Dmitry Peskov commented that the recent $61 billion aid package pledged by Washington to Kyiv will not significantly alter the dynamics on the battlefield in Ukraine.
The common housefly, caught in the clutches of the spider's web. Every move it makes just makes matters worse. Then, dinner time.
Feast on the captivating stories, videos, and helpful information on our website.
Whoa.
Dinner's ready.
Oh, man.
Escape is futile.
Just one more video.
Get stuck in our web.
TNTradio.live.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. We've got Barry Hinckley with us, who's the primary drafter of the Re-Declaration of Independence, which goes through one by one all the things that need to be fixed in America. But you're a descendant of the Minutemen, and you proudly so. For an ignorant European audience, who were the Minutemen, and why were they so important for American history? Because you want to mainstream that into this narrative of the project that you're building up.
Well, the Minutemen were the early Americans that rose up against the tyranny of the British Crown, and they felt that they didn't have the liberty and freedom that they came to America for in the first place. And so they took immense risk, including my great-grandfather and many others, because when you rose up against the crown in those days, the British didn't take it lightly, and they would often come to your house and lock you in it and burn your house down. So they took great risk to secure our liberties, and the Minutemen were the amongst the first Americans that stood up to the British crown and the British Empire and the British Army to secure our freedoms that we enjoy today.
And then the Minutemen became sort of morphed into the Continental Army. Is that right? They organized themselves, and then
yes, they were a branch of it. Of the 13 colonies, they were the Massachusetts branch, or the core of that.
Right, and it's cool. So, and your relative Colonel James Barrett was he just your great grandfather? Because it sounds as if it's further
eight,
back.
Eight generations.
Ago, yeah. Anyway, Barry, you were talking about your list of things that need to be changed and fixed. What's the next thing on your list?
So, leveling the playing field for American labor, you know, like Europe, America is highly regulated when it comes to how you treat employees and how you treat the environment, and rightfully so in most cases. However, our politicians have been allowing Asian countries and China specifically to dump cheap products onto our market without any real resistance. And whilst they pollute their environment, on the other side of the Pacific, and they abuse their labor. And that's just not fair. We need to play. If you're going to have a soccer match, what are you going to do? Both teams have to play fairly. We want the same thing for American labor and American producers.
Are you going to insist on higher standards of products that are imported, like some chain of guarantee that they were not produced with cheap labor? And or are you going to lower American standards? How are you going to enable this? How are you going to make it happen?
Well, we are overregulated here in many cases. I grew up in a manufacturing family, and I saw the blundering moves of our government create no progress in what they were trying to solve, but actually making it very difficult to make things here in the first place. However, right. We don't believe in lowering the standards and polluting the environment. But if you're going to pollute the environment on the left side or the right side, does it really matter? Or are you just still polluting the Pacific? And right, so that's if we're going to be held to a certain set of rules, so should people importing goods here.
Okay. And what's next on your list?
Energy independence. You know, America needs to be energy independent. We have the resources to be energy independent. You know, we have a massive trade deficit already, and being dependent on foreign nations, many of which have completely incongruent values to our democratic values here, is not healthy for the country. And quite frankly, we don't think it's healthy for the world to pump American dollars into rogue nations when we could be producing that energy right here.
And where would that energy come from? What about nuclear power? I've always been quite fond of nuclear power.
Yeah, it got a bad rap here with Three Mile Island and a few of the other things. And Jimmy Carter really shut down instead of saying, hey, we can do this better. Because, you know, I've always thought it's kind of an irony. We have nuclear power on our submarines, which cruise around the world and in the ocean, but we can't have them on land, which is a far less volatile environment. You know, I think that would be, you know, we believe in all of the above strategy, but we also have to tap into what we have on the ground here. We have immense resources of natural gas and oil here that we need to use.
Okay, and what's next on your list?
Enforcing American laws on Americans, not UN laws. There seems to be a big creep happening here through Washington, D.C. of UN policy. A lot of it was really highlighted during COVID with the World Health Organization starting to creep their policy into how we are directed here in the States. It's a big deal that we respond to American laws only and not to you know, global UN policies on American soil.
Fair enough. And next one.
Well, ending wokeness in the military, it's a big deal here. Our military became strong, like all militaries that are properly run, through a meritocracy, when you can come from anywhere and you work your way to the top through hard work in how you produce and perform. And right now, there's a huge DEI push within our military that is really dispiriting our troops. It's leading to recruitment shortfalls because people are getting promoted in our military over through quotas and preferences, not a meritocracy. So we need to return our military to a meritocracy.
Well, I was talking to a guy 2 weeks ago. I mean, I talked to a hell of a lot of people on this program, and he'd written, I can't remember the name of the book, but he was working for a big American think tank. And this was a truly astonishing fact that medical school students, there were more black medical school students than whites. Now, if you consider all other things being equal, that blacks constitute, 12% of the population, and let's say whites, I don't know, 60%, that means a five times overrepresentation of blacks compared to their share of the population. So it's not equal in terms of they having 12% of the medical school seats. It's as many as whites, I'm taking his word for it. Surely that's going to lead to worse outcomes on the assumption that blacks and whites are equally competent, because you're going to take from a smaller talent pool and put them in medical jobs that they're not fit for. Would you advocate that as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole concept of equity, right? So versus, you know, equality or equality of outcomes, you know, versus a meritocracy. You can't, it's reverse engineering an outcome versus allowing the best and the brightest to bubble to the top. It's totally upside down.
Okay, I assume to take the most important ones first. We've got a minute left, or a little over a minute. Barry, how successful, who are you approaching with this, and how are you sort of playing the public opinion game with this one. I mean, it's they're great ideas. How can we make them stick?
Well, we've got to get a lot of people out in front with this one. We need millions of Americans to sign it, because politicians won't do anything unless we do things in numbers and we stand together. We know that. Bill Clinton famously said, you know, politicians will never form the parade, but they'll jump out in front with a baton if you do. And he wasn't a man of high moral character, but he was a good politician. We need millions of Americans to go to redeclaration.org, read it, sign it, forward it to 10 friends, and then make sure you send it to your representative or the candidate running against them, and they agree to be held accountable to these 10 basic tenets while they're in Washington, D.C. So when they come back and ask for their job back in 2 or 6 years, whatever their cycle is, we can measure them against this.
Mm. Fantastic. Okay. Barry Hinckley, who's a descendant of the Minutemen, who were the battlers and warriors against the British Empire and for American independence, calls for a redeclaration, a new look at America's purpose nationally and in the world. And you can go to his website at redeclaration.org, and I recommend that you all sign it and consider what we've talked about in this 20-minute interview. Thank you very much, Barry. Good luck with your project. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on TNT News Talk.
Thank you, Pelle. Great.
I was a quarterback at Hardaway High School. College first round draft pick, on and off the field. We were taught to not show any signs of weakness. During the football season, I would stop eating. But I didn't know I was depressed. I thought that something was wrong with me. For 20 plus years, was physical, physical, physical. We didn't have any education behind what mental health was. I started to learn it starts here first. If this is together, I'll be better as a father, as a man, and as a husband. Put the importance on your mental health. I'm not scared to talk about it anymore. The first tool is therapy. The second one is positive self-talk. And then journaling, putting your thoughts on paper. We have to redefine what being a strong man is and heal, love, your mind.
Even the mighty might not see it coming. It's prediabetes, and it captures 1 in 3 adults. But you can escape. Take the 1-minute prediabetes risk test to know where you stand and prevent or delay type 2 diabetes. Be your own hero on smartphones everywhere at doihaveprediabetes.org.
Coming to you live from Sweden, you're with Pelle Neroth Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on this Tuesday afternoon. We've got Ingrid Carlqvist, a Swedish woman, journalist, author, who left the mainstream media in 2012 and has since been in the alternative media in Sweden. Her podcast is called Ingrid and Maria. It's available in Swedish only, but given the advances of AI, who knows whether these things can't be directly translated and found. I've known Ingrid's work for a decade, and I often admired her courage and forthrightness and the fact that she's often on the money on the big issue, even though it doesn't earn her popularity with the progressives who sit in the same quarter of Stockholm and sleep with each other and write in the same newspapers. Welcome to the show, Ingrid.
Thank you so much, Pelle. I'm so happy to be with you.
I thought we can talk just a little bit, because trying to create a theme in today's discussions, we're talking my previous guest about how American democracy needs to be rejuvenated with a 10-point plan, and how non-receptive American politicians are to the wishes of their voters. And I think this is sort of thing goes on all around Europe and America and the world, even in Sweden. And both you and I know this issue, that a lot of insiders in Sweden, we're extremely critical of Swedish democracy, extremely critical of the Swedish media. And yet the outside world and Freedom House put Sweden in the top 5 of democracies. And there's kind of total disconnect there. Anyway, there's been a sort of failure of democracy recently, well, maybe with NATO, which I'm rather against, but also this trans law, which has been passed. Nobody in Sweden wants it.
Nope.
Tell us a little bit about it. We can start there.
Yeah, it is really a mystery, Pelle. The moderate party that have the prime minister post right now, they are conservatives. And they had you know, the papers did some polls, and it was like 8% of their voters that wanted this new trans law that makes it so that someone who is only 16 years old, if they have the consent of the parents, they can change their legal gender. And it's also, it has also in it the law that people who are so-called non-binary, they should also be able to get, you know, the operations. And if you're non-binary, that means you don't want any, you don't want the male or the female stuff. So they want, they could actually make them into Barbie dolls. And that has not been discussed at all, only on my podcast with Maria. But it's very strange. Why are they doing it? And the Prime Minister, he didn't want to talk to the media about this, but we learned from the media, from sources inside the party, that he had said to his group in Parliament that this is personally important to me, so I need you to vote with me. And they all did. And they all did. Only one person from the moderate party said no to this law. So why are they doing it? I have sort of a feeling it could be like, you know, before the Sweden Democrats came into Parliament, the moderates was the horrible ones, you know, the Social Democrats always call them ghosts of the right and so on. So they have lost some many voters in the big cities, and they have lost women, female voters. So I think that he thought that he could make himself popular in these groups, but why? Why would he go for that group when most of his voters hate this law?
Well, I mean, won't he lose as many voters as he'll gain? Maybe he'll gain some young women or something, but he might lose, I don't know, older men or something. And was it a free vote? I mean, was it, because in the UK politics, is usually on moral issues, you're allowed a free vote. You're not party whipped, piskan in Swedish. Why did
it was not a free vote? No. All the parties had the whip on them. So there was,
that's terrible.
There was one woman from the Conservative Party and one man from the Social Democrats that voted no. And I guess both of them have decided not to run in the next election.
Yeah.
Because if they wanted to run one more time, they would have said no to them. They would have kicked them out. In the next election.
Well, and one of the most persuasive, I read a book a few years ago, I'll say it in Swedish, so you know, Knapptryckarkompaniet, which means the button pressing company. It's a very, very negative view of Swedish politics, this country that's lionized in the rest of the world and praised. Because basically, this party list system, which is decided from, if you at the bottom, you'll get voted from the top to the bottom. So if you're placed in a certain place in the list, you're very unlikely to get that seat. And so all the power is with the party leaders and two or three or four or five people. And the parties don't need the voters' money because it's basically their state funded. So they're completely independent of the voters and they have enormous power over MPs. So, I mean, I criticize British and American politics a lot, but I mean, at least in the UK, you've got independent committees voting through MPs, and they do sometimes vote against their parties, but you never get that in Sweden. I think once in the FRA law, one liberal voted against it, and of course she was kicked out the next time or put down the bottom of the list. So she was committed career suicide just by voting against her government. And that's the reality of Swedish democracy.
It is. And the only time that they care about the voters is every 4 years when there is elections to the parliament. So I think that probably our prime minister, he will keep his fingers crossed and think that people will have forgotten about this when it comes to the next election, 2026, because they are really also doing some good stuff. And that's why I think so many of the conservative parliamentaries, why they didn't take the risk to make the prime minister upset, is because that Sweden is in a very dangerous position. You know that we have all these this shootings, these explosions, and people are very, very scared these days. So he that the government are actually doing a lot of things to, you know, more the punishments will go up. They will have, they will sit in prison for more years, and they will lower the age where you can be sent to prisons. And I think that most of them thought that this is so much more. We cannot risk a new election. Say that the prime minister says, "Okay, you don't vote for me, I will leave," and that would have been worse than the transfer. Right. I think that is how they resonated.
Right. Yeah. Fair enough. Well, tell us a little bit about this, because one thing, you know, when we grew up, Sweden was famous for ABBA and strawberries and midsummer and free sex and swimming naked in the summer evening lake and all that package of naive, innocent country. Now, all articles are about Sweden's having the highest gun shooting death rate. You know, it's like 20 times higher than the UK or something. Tell us a little bit about that story, because I want, even though it's very, very well known to you in Sweden, not enough foreigners know all the details. So tell us about it. Is it really that bad?
I think it has a lot to do with the so-called Titanic nationalism that Swedes suffer from. You see, we know that we are the best country in the world. We know that we are the best people in the world. And so everybody that comes here immediately will see that, oh, their way of living is dramatically much more better than ours. So they will become just like us. But we didn't tell them that we are the best country in the world and the best people in the world. I'm sort of joking, but I think you know there is a lot of truth in it. So because if you are the best, you're not supposed to
boast about it.
Yeah.
Talk about
So we never did. We never told them that our system is way better than yours. And then the government and the journalists started telling people that when they did say something like that, they said, "You're a racist. All people in the world have the same right to be in Sweden as you. You were just lucky in the lottery of life." And that is so stupid to say, because we made this country, our forefathers made this country. And it's not a coincidence that we used to be the most quiet and peaceful country in the world. And now we are one of the most horrible, the most criminal countries in the world. Yeah. Because we thought that everybody would see that our way is much better than theirs, who always scream and shout and fight and kill each other. So now here we are.
Well, I saw that the World Peace Index, Sweden is, it's not the lowest country in Europe. Albania and Bulgaria, I think, are lower, but it's certainly the lowest. It's not in a group of countries it wants to belong to, put it that way. And of course, you know, as you said, Swedes think, well, everyone wants to be Swedish. Everybody wants to be like us when they come here, rather than thinking, well, maybe they want to keep their own tradition. So there's a kind of silent arrogance about that. And also Swedes, it's a sort of homogeneous country where values and beliefs are kind of transmitted almost telepathically, because everybody thinks the same as a homogeneous society. But the immigrants didn't get that message, because they do. So it's what they call, it's a low context society. You don't spell things out because you assume people understand, rather than drawing the line and putting barriers and creating clear rules of behavior, like, let's say, the US Constitution, maybe. Sweden never had that. Sweden's a legalistic society. I think America's a legalistic society, partly because they have all these people coming in from other countries. They're very legalistic and have lawyers everywhere. Sweden doesn't have any lawyers almost. It's like a tribe, or whatever you think. So what we've got here, I just saw, are you from Malmö or Helsingborg or somewhere?
I've lived in both cities, and now I live in the countryside, but still in Skåne.
You're from my part of the Sweden I grew, part of Sweden I partly grew up in. Is Malmö, of course. Malmö's got this Eurovision Song Contest. It's going to be all in the headlines in the next few weeks, because we're going to see Northern Europe's Marseille, if you like, and you've got an Israeli singer. What do you expect is going to happen? Is it going to be a big bust up there?
Yeah, I'm really scared. We can have everything from, you know, just violent demonstrations, shouting that Israel shouldn't be there and so on, up to a terrorist attack. And I just read in one of our newspapers this morning that they talked to the Attorney General, and he said Gunnar Strömmer, and they asked him how safe it is. And he said that, well, the police, I think that they are on top of it. But when it comes to a decision, everyone has to make their own decision. And that really scared me, because I read that he also is very, very afraid that there will be some attack at this place. And he doesn't want to say to people, oh, it's okay, everything is fine, nothing will happen. And all the friends I have in Malmö that I have talked to, they said they are not going to stay in Malmö for that week. They have planned holidays abroad or going to Stockholm or something like that. They will not stay there. They will not be in Malmö.
I mean, I made a film about Malmö a few years ago, and I looked into the Jewish issue there. Because Malmö, of course, I'll just give a bit of background, was the first port of call for people from the continent in 1945. And it's been mythologized in the white buses. You know, they're these white buses that went down to the continent. Mostly they took Scandinavians, actually, from the concentration camps. I guess some of them were Jews. But I mean, this self-belief in the Swedes were that they saved the Jews, and that people starving wrecks from the Dachau turned up and they got Swedish food when they arrived in Malmö. I guess many of them stayed. So Malmö had this reputation as an open city, especially for Jews. But now, of course, there are hardly any Jews left. I mean, literally, is it 50 or 100 or something?
Something like that.
And I remember my mother's doctor was Jewish, and she came up to my mother's flat once, and she was breathing heavily. She's a woman in her 60s, and she'd just been chased on the main square. I think it was the riots of 2009, you know. And I saw terror in her eyes. And I guess there's going to be more of that and of course, this is very, you know, how's Malmö going to cope with that? Because it has this image of openness and helping refugees. And that's partly the reason why they let in so many refugees in 2015, because they said, well, it's the new Holocaust, you know, the new Jewish exodus from Syria. Of course, they were not Jews. They were Muslims. But now we're going to see it. What do you think the view is going to be of Malmö after this, after this Eurovision Song Contest? Are we going to have a...
I don't know. I, as I said, I'm very scared. I think it could be really ugly, and people could die in terror attacks or in these, riots. The demonstrations, many times they turn into riots. And I think that, even though I don't want it to happen, I don't want people to get hurt or killed, but if something really bad happens, maybe the politicians of Malmö will have to go in another direction. You know, they have been boasting about that, oh, we are such an open city and people from 200 different countries live here and everything is hunky-dory. It's just that there are no Swedes left, or very few Jews, but not so many Swedes either, because the Swedes, it's not our city anymore. You see Muslims everywhere, women in hijabs and men in long dresses, and it's just, since they are so many, especially the Muslims, and the Social Democrats have run Malmö for 100 years or something like that, with a few episodes of conservative, but not much. It's always been the Social Democrats. And they turn to the Muslim voters and they tell them that if you vote for us, we will keep giving you benefits and you don't have to work and you can just, and we don't mess with you if you say bad things in the mosque. Or, I mean, there's been a big stories about how the preschool children, that they're forcing the teachers of the preschool to put the hijab on 2-3 year old little girls, and they are telling the people who work there that you must do this, otherwise we will make a lot of fuss about this. They are stuck Because if they suddenly, you know, start telling the Muslims, you can't do these, you can't, then they will not vote for the Social Democrats anymore. And the Social Democrats, they only want to be in power. They don't care about Sweden. They don't care about Malmo. They don't care about the Swedes. They just want to be in power.
And I just, sorry, I've got to wind up in a minute. So I'll say, Malmo is a huge net recipient of benefits from the rest of Sweden. So we can afford Sweden can afford Malmo, but if the whole of Sweden becomes like Malmo, a recipient of benefits, as it were, an unproductive population, a very low employment rate in Sweden, in Malmo, then Sweden will go bankrupt. And of course, these people vote for the Social Democrats, which is the leftist party. And if they don't vote for the Social Democrats, who keep giving them benefits, they might vote for some Islamist party or anything. Anything is possible. It's a tricky situation. But Ingrid, we'd love to have you on again. Brilliant exposition of Sweden's third largest city's problems, and of course, Malmö's going to be in the spotlight very shortly during the Eurovision Song Contest on this 50th anniversary of ABBA singing at Waterloo. Is this Sweden's Waterloo? Anyway, thanks, Ingrid Kolfitz, this journalist. You can find her on Twitter or on her blogs and various other places. Thank you very much. This is the Pelle Nerroth Taylor Show on Tuesday afternoon. Thanks, Ingrid. Bye.